You are listening to The Dark Corner with DJ Evil Dave and Starfleet Lieutenant Commander Brandy Jekyll.
Hello, one and all, and welcome to this, The Dark Corner podcast, with your host, DJ Evil Dave. On yet another solo excursion, we had planned to record the episode on the tarot, not the world, but the one before that, Judgment. But with Brandy getting her COVID and flu shot, she wasn't quite feeling up to it. She just kind of wanted to lay about and do really nothing much this weekend. Though we did go to the movies, and that's something we'll get into a little later. I thought, since it's October and we do one extra episode in October, I'd try to squeeze something else in, and that something is a discussion on horror comedy. There's Nobi reacting to me apparently talking to no one yet again. That, and it's past my usual bedtime, and it is a Sunday night, with Monday being a holiday, the holiday I'd prefer to call Indigenous Peoples Day, but a holiday nonetheless. I thought I'd take the opportunity, since I have all that day to edit, to record this evening. So with all that behind-the-scenes stuff addressed, I suppose we should get into some news and reviews and etc. Many of you know that we've adopted an outdoor cat and have been trying to take care of another stray we found in the neighborhood that we call Creamsicle because he's the color of a creamsicle. But our other outdoor cat we've been calling Growler because he purrs so loud that it sounds like he growls. We've bought another heated cat house as winter is coming, and we wanted additional shelter for all these outdoor cats. And Growler loves it already. I put him in just to have him test it out. He started fluffing the carpeted pad inside. I had a lay down. Often when we go outside, he's in there just kind of staring at us or asleep or having a bath. I went out earlier today and he was on his side, his eyes just wide open, just looking at me. So it's nice that he likes his new house. It's bigger. I think that has something to do with it than the other heated cat house we had bought a while ago. And it has a door in the front and the back, so if any other critters come at him, he won't feel trapped. He can go in there and hide, and if worse comes to worse, he can leave through the back door. Speaking of it getting cooler, took the air conditioning unit out of the window so we could close it up when it comes to having to heat the house again. Brandy is fortunate as the bedroom where she does a lot of recording of her podcasts and video gaming, etc., is a smaller room, and the small unit in there doesn't get too cool during the winter, and so heating that room is pretty easy. Cooling that room also pretty easy, as you just shut the door. So we usually just leave the air conditioning in these recent years anyhow. It was Band Camp Friday recently, and I bought a lot of the EPs by The Glow of Streetlights, and if you want to hear a little bit of The Glow of Streetlights' music, my SoundCloud playlist right now for October starts with a song by The Glow of Streetlights to kind of give you a feel of this dark hip-hop. But he's based in Florida and couldn't evacuate, and worked with a program to assist people during the hurricane, after the hurricane. Was living in one of the areas without power and limited water. Occasionally he'd check his phone, but couldn't do very much. Found out that he broke records on Bandcamp, you know, his own personal records for sales of music and merchandise. So a lot of people coming out to offer support, which includes me. I bought everything except the album that I had purchased long ago.
My home is a fortress, my girlfriend is gorgeous, I smoke on her porches. You are a forfeit, inject you with venom, I feel like a murderer.
Spot, The Obliging Victim's latest EP, which Kelly Conbrink wrote for a non-existent zombie movie in his horror-themed psychedelic rock way, and I've enjoyed that. Picked up some Byronic Sex and Exile, a compilation called We Stand, where the proceeds go to Planned Parenthood, and a couple of the Uncovered albums by Unwoman, who you've heard on many of our music specials, doing sort of a Victorian industrial kind of sound, cello and other string-heavy stuff. Picked up some free stuff, too. There is a collaboration between Gothsicles and Angel Spit that I grabbed. Artifact Records released a compilation called Heavy, which features their more metal-oriented bands. I already have a lot of the tracks that are on that compilation, but I picked it up just the same. Arclight Halo released a track, so it was a good haul. Movie night, we actually went out into the weird, wild world, masked up, of course, to the theaters to see Bros, the gay romantic comedy by Billy Eichner, which you might know from Billy on the Street. You may have seen him also in Parks and Recreation and a few other things. It's a delightful comedy with a lot of heart, featuring a lot of queer actors across the whole LGBTQ plus community. It co-stars Luke McFarlane as Aaron, Billy Eichner playing Bobby, which I think is probably a reference to Sondheim's Company, the 30-something that doesn't want to commit to a relationship. Guy Branum really shines. I've liked Guy Branum for a long time, since I first started following LA comedy. He used to appear on that Chris Hardwick show At Midnight. He hosted a game show for a while. He did, I think it was called Pop Rocket, a podcast on the Maximum Fun Network. And if you are longtime listeners to My Favorite Murder, he appeared on that show to talk about The Law, if I'm not mistaken. Brandy was happy to see Jim Rash from Community. He played the Dean. Jim played this bisexual member of this board at the first LGBTQ plus museum, which features as a pretty central setting for the film. Really, it touches upon a lot of the tropes of your standard romantic comedy while also poking fun at them. There are many jabs at Hallmark's sudden appeal or attempt to appeal to the queer community by featuring, you know, queer rom-coms of their own, queer Christmas movies. But Billy Eichner plays this podcaster, and very early on, he's recording the podcast and slapping the table, which I found pretty humorous because that's like a no-no when it comes to podcasting. But then I thought back to, let's say again, My Favorite Murder, when they would record on handheld microphones and you'd hear cord noises and them bumping the microphone a lot. The same thing would happen with the Jackie and Laurie show, which is also on Maximum Fun. You know, two stand-up comedians talking about stand-up comedy as women. I really enjoyed it. It's super funny. We really loved the arguments at the table for what should be the main room for this LGBTQ plus museum. And Billy Eichner was really pushing, or Bobby, you know, the character was really pushing for a Lincoln section, because there's a lot of theorizing these days that Lincoln was gay. Of course, Jim Rash's character saying bisexual, he had a wife and children, so if he did write lots of seemingly love letters to men and apparently had slept in the same bed as other men, that maybe he swung both ways. But really, we don't know. There's no clear evidence, so it's an uphill battle. But a lot of Bobby's drive is behind queer erasure. He's a queer historian, and so his whole life is devoted to being out and proud. So we get to that argument that always happens in romantic comedies where there's some kind of disagreement. When we have Aaron, who is less open about his queerness, and so when having Bobby meet the family, he asks Bobby to tone it down, which of course is code for don't appear so queer. So of course there's a falling out and then a getting back together again. All the points of a rom-com, but done with kind of a brilliant slant to it and with a lot of heart. There is a speech that Billy Eichner does as Bobby about seeming confident and how it's really an act, because all your life you're told that you're a great singer, but because your walk is apparently gay or flamboyant and your speeching, you know, your speech pattern's flamboyant, that there's going to be less roles for you as a singer or actor. And as a writer, that if you're writing to a queer audience, that it's going to limit the audience, and you're unlikely to find a publisher. All these things that are to turn him down or turn him away. But on the other hand, he talks about having a very supportive family. So, you know, there are elements of love and support that he's getting, but from society overall, and even from people in the queer community, like his own professors, this internalized homophobia and just putting the same limitations on him as they do on themselves. It's deep. It's funny, and it's deep and poignant. And there's moments that Bobby's talking about how that being queer is not a monolith, that there's dumb gays too. Even though the queer community has convinced the straight community that they're somehow smarter, it's not necessarily the case. So I recommend seeing it. I really enjoyed it. Brandy enjoyed it too. We laughed. I'm sure Brandy teared up quite a few times during it. It pulled at the heartstrings, that's for sure. And very well acted, very well written, and has a satisfying end. So yes, if you haven't seen Bros, go ahead and see it. I think it really delivers. And if you're a fan of Saturday Night Live, Bowen Yang has a pretty prominent role in it too, towards the third act. Here's something else. We've been playing the hell out of the Saints Row kind of reboot. It's hard to tell what exactly people are calling it, but Saints Row 2022. I've platinumed it. I've managed to get all the trophies. Got 97 completion in-game, with it tracking my save progress, you know, how far I've gone. There's a bit of a bug. There's this Boot Hill prize that for some reason I didn't win, even though I succeeded at the Boot Hill mission. So I'm not sure what that's about. So for whatever reason, I was stuck at 97. I was also unhappy as to where I had put some of the ventures. They didn't make sense. You get another headquarters, and I had put it too close to my first headquarters. So it was really inconvenient. I should have had it on the other side of this big old lake. So I went ahead and restarted, and I'm playing again. I think I'm at about 10% progress right now. Just kind of doing missions as they pop up. I've really enjoyed it. It's a lot of fun. I went in to the Style app, which is on your character's phone, where you can change the way you look, the way you sound, your personality, like voice and emotes. And I made She-Hulk, because we're enjoying the hell out of that series. And then I made Imperator Furiosa from Fury Road, as there's a very specific kind of makeup type that you can put on that covers the forehead and goes below the eyes. As there is a lot of a Southwest setting, in fact, one of the missions is very much lifted from Fury Road, where you're following a convoy into a sandstorm. And I think that's added a lot of charm to what's already a light and fun game, is this Southwest setting. It's kind of Tex-Mex music style during battles, and just that feeling of Arizona, Texas, Southern Utah, just that kind of American Southwest feel. Touches of Breaking Bad and Better Call Saul. And a little bit of Las Vegas, too, is the place called El Dorado, where a lot of the casinos are run down. It's not as deep or layered or as dense as Saints Row 2, or even really 3, though 3 in its own right was a bit lighter in tone. But that might be a good thing, because it really is as if they took Grand Theft Auto and just made it woke in the best way. The humor never feels mean-spirited. It doesn't ever seem like they're punching down. Your gang's diverse, with their own history, with their own personalities. They're rounded enough not to be a stereotype. And there seems to be actual heart and connection between the characters. There's these missions called, Cleanup Crew, I think it's called. But anyway, you go and clean up crime scenes. Well, your crew does, but if there's ever a problem, you have to drive out to the area, fix whatever problem it is, usually a dead body in a car, and drive it off somewhere without having the police catch you. And at the start of these missions, you're usually doing something for your friends, like you're at a book signing, or you're at an art show about to buy a piece of art for one of your friends. Just generally out doing something, like the love language thing about, you know, gifts, something that you know your friend likes. It really all coalesces in the climax when it just out and out says that, yeah, friendship, that was the whole point of this, that it wasn't going to be any tragedy or anything like that. It was just about being friends and finding support in your friends. No, it has its critics. Imagine partly because of the wokeness of the content, which I like, actually. And its seemingly rushed development, though really I think it's because it was released a day earlier than it should have been, because I think a patch came soon after that fixed a lot of the early bugs, because people were reviewing it way too early before it was fully patched. Still gets buggy every once in a while, but if you shut off the PlayStation and reboot, usually you're fine again. Little things like not being able to access your guns, not being able to talk to an NPC to further a mission, just weird little things like that. It might even freeze if too much is taking place on screen. I've had that happen on occasion. Or it might boot you off, but not often. It's not nearly as bad as Cyberpunk was for booting me off. And just the occasional save after doing something important will assist. And there's an autosave feature too. But really not that bad of a game, and something I'd recommend if you would like a crime simulator that's not as mean-spirited as a Grand Theft Auto. Also, Grand Theft Auto has this passivity to it often, that you're more passively enjoying whatever Rockstar North's writers are doing. Grand Theft Auto 4 was really bad for this, in that you'd go passively see a variety show at this Russian club, or go see a comedy act at some comedy club in New York. And that's not gameplay. You're just watching something. It's not even a mini game at that rate. So yeah, Saints Row, really enjoy it. I think with that, we'll end news and reviews and go into the dark track. So with horror comedy, it seemed fitting to pick a comedy act. and one that I enjoy a lot is Goth Brooks. This band from Arizona takes an approach that reminds me of Dred Zeppelin, if some of you remember that band, which seems a bit problematic now, probably even problematic then, but Dred Zeppelin was a Led Zeppelin tribute band that would do songs in reggae style with an Elvis impersonator on lead vocals. It sounds bizarre, but somehow worked. And they do other covers as well, like they do Aerosmith and a few other things as well, but mostly Led Zeppelin covers. But here, Goth Brooks combines country western music and a little rockabilly too with gothic industrial style. It just kind of merges those two things. And with a lot of samples and such, and you can hear some of the influences. You know, in one song, I think it's called Freak Out, there's a little bit of Sisters of Mercy in there, which is fun. But this song comes off another album, and that is Freakabilly, and it's called The Redneck Undead. So here's Goth Brooks with The Redneck Undead.
Mind with nowhere to go.
Freakabilly is less country and western oriented than their previous album was, Mascara and Moonshine. That had very heavy western influences. But this, you could hear a little bit of it in there, kind of a country jig kind of sound in bits of it. But that is Garth Brooks in a nutshell, kind of that screeching industrial sound, kind of dark electro style, with a hint of the country western added for flavor.
Hello and welcome to the Black Dog Podcast version 2.0, the shut-in cinema.
Let me out.
Yay. Yay. I was going to do something dramatic and try and make something up about like we're frozen in time or something.
But don't peek too soon. Don't peek too soon.
No, we're not going to peek too soon. We're back. I'm Lee.
Darren.
I'm Jim.
I'm Elton.
Oh, we got there. We're in. We're moving.
Let's all touch. No, mustn't. No.
We're all exactly 200 million miles apart, just as it says in rules and regs and everything.
Okay, now I've got a cat on my lap, purring away. But let's get into this topic. I would like to talk about horror comedies and how horror and comedy are very similar. So when they partner up, I think it works really well. I know there are people out there that are not fans of horror comedy, that they'd prefer for horror to scare and not delight like, you know, comedy would. I think that a good horror comedy can kind of do both. That if you balance it well, there can be very frightening, unsettling moments and moments of genuine laughter. Earlier, I kind of compiled a list of topics to address in similarities between horror and comedy, you know, where the two align. One is just in having a comic relief character, somebody who lightens the tension. You'll find them in a lot of horror movies. You know, a lot of people look at Aliens as more of an action movie, but if you look at Hudson, very much a comedy relief character, always freaking out, being an avatar for the audience, you know, being a cipher for the audience and saying the things the audience would be saying, like, let's just get out of here, put the kid in charge. It's comedy relief that I think separates a tragedy from a comedy. Because if you look at certain comedies, often they're about bad things happening, like The Money Pit. If you took some of the funnier elements away from The Money Pit, it would just be dreadful. A terribly upsetting and depressing drama of sunk costs into a poor real estate choice that leads to a division within a relationship. So without the lighter tone, without those bits to break that tension, it would just disturb and upset. So there has to be this kind of release valve, and I think you find that in both comedies and in a lot of horror. We get the TSA agent in Get Out, who again is kind of a cipher for the audience, the one that is kind of guessing what's going on. I mean, he's wrong, but he understands that there's something wrong going on and shows up at the end of the movie to help save the day. In earlier horror movies, the comic relief would be usually the working class. I'm thinking of classic 30s horror films, you know, just the early days of the talkies. And you'd have the Cockney drivers or maids or other working class people, you know, the peasantry around the area, who would be more superstitious, let's say, and express their feelings of genuine fear in a funny way. This is prevalent in Bride of Frankenstein, which I'm not much of a fan. A lot of people prefer Bride of Frankenstein to other Frankenstein movies in the series, even the first one. But speaking of horror comedies, I think it does lean hard into the comedy. There's that weird bit about the homunculi, these experiments of these tiny people, the king and queen that had to be separated because the king was super horny and kept cheating on the queen, and if the queen ever got a hold of him, she'd kill him. All kept in these jars. The hermit that was supposedly in this remote area where Frankenstein's monster found, that gets parodied in Young Frankenstein. But then it turns out that this hermit lives right along this road that's traveled frequently enough to have this patrol come by and find the creature. One of the best elements being the bride herself, who has very little screen time. However, there's just kind of a campiness to the whole film. Of course, Bride of Frankenstein was directed by James Whale, also directed the original Frankenstein, but also a film called The Dark House, which is a brilliant film and probably my favorite of his. And it also features a lot of camp, but pretty well balanced. There's something about Bride of Frankenstein that feels almost like a National Lampoon movie or something like that, where things just kind of happen that don't necessarily connect to one another. They're just vignettes that are loosely combined. So you just experience these scenarios with the creature, but it doesn't really come together as a full narrative. The Dark House, there's mystery and intrigue. This nouveau riche fella that breaks down, goes to an old house. There's a lot of Rocky Horror vibes to it. And that this weird, eccentric family has this dark secret that gets revealed as the film goes on. Very atmospheric, quite funny, and playing with more liberal attitudes of the youth at the time. And so you kind of have this class struggle as well, this new, young, rich generation against this stuffy, old, uptight, kind of sinister generation pitted against one another in this old house. And it's a healthy approach to female sexuality, which is, of course, pre-code era filmmaking. Is kind of refreshing. I mean, even by today's standards, the way it approaches female sexuality is quite interesting. Yeah, The Dark House, legitimately funny for the time. There was a period in which the Universal Monsters, you know, the appeal was kind of dying down a little bit, but they'd have them meet Abbott and Costello in several films, and that reinvigorated the franchise a bit. But by then, I think it was too late to really continue in that horror vein when you're fully making horror comedies with the beloved double act of Abbott and Costello, meeting the Wolfman or meeting Frankenstein or, you know, Dracula or what have you. So I talked about a little bit about the class struggle that you find in both horror and comedy, you know, dressed in The Dark House and some of the comic relief characters you see in horror films being the lower class. But something horror and comedy can do well is address issues of classism. Think of the classic Prince and the Pauper story, being able to switch those roles. You get that in a lot of comedies. But in horror, you can see it as the weird attitudes that come with wealth, in particular generational wealth. That if you think, you know, particularly with royal families, that there's a history of inbreeding to keep wealth within the family, to keep power within the family, to marry your cousins and stuff, where you get, was her name Elizabeth Bathory? Not Bathory, from listening to the Morbid podcast, I think her name's actually Bathory. It was said to have bathed in the blood of virgins, though that's a bit apocryphal. It is said that she may have smeared her body in the blood of her victims, but yes, torture was very much her kink. You'd find that with several wealthy, powerful individuals throughout history. That power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. There's the film You're Next that has the dinner party of this wealthy family, and this boyfriend invites his girlfriend along, failing to realize that she is she comes from a family of survivalists, or her father was a survivalist, and so she grew up knowing how to take care of herself. And so when a home invasion happens, she manages to survive, only to have it turn out that it's someone within the family looking to knock off other members of the family in order to win the inheritance. Have society where a teenager discovers that his family belongs to a weird sex orgy cult. Recently, we had Crimson Peak with its story of incest and a formerly wealthy family in dire straits, and the desperation to have investors to keep the family line going. It's pretty funny because on Twitter I saw someone talk about Crimson Peak and how they're really enjoying the film, and then suddenly, boom, incest. And it's like, well, nope, that's in keeping with gothic fiction. If you look at Matthew Lewis's The Monk, has incest as a very central plot point, which kind of seals the monk's fate, really, of all of the things he does. This incestuous relationship is central. So really the thing that kind of people might not have liked about the movie is really authentic to gothic fiction. On the other hand, you can kind of flip that and you get something like the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, which Tobe Hooper admits to having being a comedy. That after the Vietnam War, there was some disillusionment and some disenfranchisement in the American dream and what that's all about. The American family and family values, and what is the core moral value of the United States. And what you have is turning on its head this American family, this Norman Rockwell kind of setting. And that's where you get this family of cannibals in the middle of Texas. One of them that's very Ed Gein-like because, you know, it was partly inspired by Ed Gein of desecrating grave sites. And then Leatherface, who in the absence of a female figure in the home had adopted the feminine role of wearing a mask over his face and putting on makeup and a frilly apron and that sort of thing, doing the cooking and maybe the cleaning, you know, taking up the role of the woman of the house. And you can see little bits of comedy, however disturbing that, you know, Texas Chainsaw Massacre is, and it is. It still remains one of the most frightening movies I've ever seen. It's harrowing. But there's this look that Leatherface gives after so many of these wayward teenagers keep straying into the house, and he has to kill them. I'm putting them in a freezer, hanging them up on a hook, sticking a chainsaw in them in a wheelchair. And just this look of frustration and like, what is going on? All these kids coming to my house. This is not anything I asked for. It's like when you don't expect visitors. It's like the same kind of look as like you get a knock on the door and you just kind of like, what's going on? I'm not prepared to take in visitors. I haven't cleaned. My hair's a mess. Both horror and comedy provide opportunities to make social commentary. Science fiction has that too. Science fiction taking things to kind of the next level, the next extreme, kind of like putting a multiple next to it. While comedy can look at kind of the lighter side of things and kind of poke fun at situations like racism, you get something like a lot of the Richard Pryor films of the time. Blazing Saddles does this really well. the black sheriff and how it addresses that. People say that they couldn't make that these days. It's like, I don't know. With the skilled hand, I think someone could make a Blazing Saddles-like comedy. Sexism as well. I was listening to the Feminine Critique earlier, and Emily and Christine brought up an interesting point about how diverse horror can be. And it's gotten better, because there was, back in the day, the black person in the film being the first victim. It's like, it's diverse, but the first person to die is the black person? Why is that? And we've seen that trope kind of die out with the years. But still, there's the final girl in your slasher movies. This woman who manages to survive through her own wits and capabilities and what have you. And you can take this kind of to the extreme with I Spit on Your Grave, the revenge to sexual assault, and how this woman who survives this encounter uses her wiles to lure in the perpetrators to kill them. But you also get your Ripley in Alien, admired for her practicality, though people still criticize her for going back for the cat. But in terms of racism, go back to the Night of the Living Dead with a black male protagonist. And there's some maybe retconning about the casting, that Romero may have just cast the best actor in the lead role and then only afterwards made a point of the race aspect of it. And even the good old boy sheriff, the police killing him at the end and mistaking him for one of the zombies and having that be a statement. And while we're on zombies, you can go to the statement of commercialism that we get with setting Dawn of the Dead in the mall. You also get that with Chopping Mall, the remake of Dawn of the Dead. Night of the Comet, which Movies That Made Us Gay recently did a retrospective on, this setting, particularly of the 80s, of the mall being the center for human activity. Dawn of the Dead being that the zombies would go to the mall just out of habit, that consumerism was such a brainless activity that they just continued to do that thing. You get a little bit of that in Shaun of the Dead too, of just the menial tasks that zombies would grow accustomed to doing. And so at the end of the film, you can find zombies doing things like cart returns at a grocery store. So what other similarities are there between horror and comedy? They both elicit a reflexive reaction, an autonomic response, which is either fear or, a start, a jump, or laughter, a smile, a giggle. And some people can get angry at a horror film for having, cheap jump scares, things that just shock or startle you, like a loud noise, a bang, or somebody off screen throws a cat inexplicably at the protagonist, or there's silence and a phone rings really, really loudly. Little things to elicit a fear response. Well, comedy is something that is shocking or unexpected, silly, something that upsets expectations and causes you to laugh. It could be somebody behaving in an unacceptable way, like a common trope, a common archetype in comedies is the man-child, which you can see as being a horror archetype too. The fully grown adult with the mental, emotional age of a child. Get that a little bit again with, kind of your leather faces, your Jasons, this arrested development type character. But you get that something in like a Will Ferrell movie. Something like Step Brothers, where they're fully grown adults, but they're acting like they're 14 or something. That can be either funny because of it just being socially awkward or weird, or it can be downright frightening. Setup and punchline. A good joke has a nice setup to it, and you get this with callbacks too. So for a joke to pay off, it really should have something leading up to it, kind of like lighting the fuse to a bomb, to, you know, a stick of dynamite or something. It's that bit of suspense, that bit of anticipation, and then boom, the delivery, which both comedy and horror do well. There's this expectation, this suspense, as you're waiting for either the frightening or the funny thing to happen. If you look at old cartoons, you know, the Wile E. Coyote kind of contraptions, the painting of a tunnel on the cliff surface, you know, the side of a cliff. So if the Roadrunner comes speeding through, they'll slam right smack dab into the side of a cliff, only to run through it, you know? Upset expectations, but there's also that building up, and then having the coyote try to run through the tunnel as well and not be able to. You get the creeping around a dark house and kind of that over-the-shoulder camera thing where you almost have a point of view of the protagonist, and then the camera might pan around so you can see this empty space over the shoulder, and you're just waiting that for that to be filled with something, you know, some creeper, and then it turns back around and they jump from the other side. Just a bit of suspense, a bit of build up, and then payoff. Deliver gags. That's something both horror and comedy do. Gags are often, you know, sight gags. They're visual things in a comedy. Somebody with a fake mustache that has the mustache coming off slowly, and, you know, find that funny because there's that comedic irony of something the audience knows that the character does not, that their disguise is faltering. The toilet paper at the bottom of the shoe, the unzipped fly, the torn pants, you know, all these visual gags to deliver comedy. You get the same thing in horror. They use the term gags as well, but the gags are often the kills. It's the axe in the head. It's the arrow through the eye. It's the decapitation, the impalement, the being set afire, you know, all these things are gags. Which I think brings us to slapstick, that violence in a comedy can be cartoonish. You know, just smacking each other, hitting one another in the head with the 2x4, you know, pokes in the eyes, pulls of the hair, or back in, you know, the silent era with Buster Keaton or Charlie Chaplin. These were sight gags as well, but they were stunts on top of that. In horror, the violence can be a bit more extreme. If you look at, we were talking earlier about Your Next, which is if you took Home Alone and stripped it a little bit of its cartoonishness, that you set this board with nails protruding at the inside of a window. So when a home invader breaks through the window and steps on, they get a nail through the foot. That can happen in both instances, but in the one, it looks extremely painful, and in the other, it's painful but elicits laughter instead of kind of a cringe. So what's different between horror and comedy? This is something that was brought up in a panel we attended at FanX. And I probably won't try to go too deep in this because the panelist does workshops on this sort of thing, on writing, and he didn't want his panel recorded or anything. But at the same time, it's like doing a TED Talk or anything else. If you're going to have a panel and you're going to do a panel for free, you know, why are you sharing information if you don't expect people to adopt or also share it? It's not like a sworn to secrecy sort of thing, but I'm going to give his name just the same, and you can look out for more of this stuff. He's written a lot of books, does writing workshops, and so on. But his name is Michael Brent Collings, and I believe Michael Brent is all one word. Michael Brent Collings. Now, there's two major things that separate horror from comedy. One is distance, the other is lighting. Distance is how close you are to the action. Comedy, you are an observer. You're outside, you're at a distance, you're not as emotionally connected to events going on. If you look at somebody walking around reading a newspaper and they step into an open manhole, if you see that from a distance, it's shocking, surprising, and funny. If you are close in with that person and follow them down that manhole and see what, you know, the result is, if you're basically with that character, you know, doing the over-the-shoulder thing, or, you know, just in tight and close with that character, it's more intimate. And as such, you are more sympathetic, more empathic with what that character is experiencing. So when they fall down that manhole, yeah, you're there with them. You're going down the manhole too. So that's what is meant by the distance. And it's an emotional distance too. If you don't know somebody and they slip on some ice and fall, it's you could probably laugh about it, even against your own will. It's just, you know, sometimes somebody falling is funny. But if they injure themselves, it's another story. And if you know them, there is more likely that response is, oh my God, did they injure themselves? Are they okay? You know, if it's somebody you care and love for and not some stranger, it seems cruel, but yes, you're more likely to have a response like, oh my God, are they hurt? Than you were possibly with a stranger, unless you're just a very empathic person. So distance kind of means those two things. It's emotional distance. It's also the distance of the camera. I mean, how close are you in on the action? Horror is very intimate. Lots of close-ups right up in there. Comedy, from a distance. Kind of objective, subjective positions. The other is lighting, and lighting creates mood. Horror is dark. There's a reason why it's an old dark house and not, you know, lit up to the nines. And yeah, you can have horror movies in the daylight. We get that with Texas Chainsaw Massacre. Midsommar is that way too. There are these horror films that take place in broad daylight, but often it's searingly bright or so overwhelmingly colorful that there's a shift, a gradient. Comedy's well lit because you want to see what's going on. It's lighter by, you know, definition. Horror often relies on the mysterious, the dark. There's the unknown, and that's what's frightening. And when you explain away the unknown, when you tell everybody who the monster is, what the monster wants, how the monster is destroyed, you know, it starts to lose its allure, its power over your fear response. It's like the more you know about how to repel or kill vampires, the less scary they become. If you think of the horror movies you've seen, and if you think of the comedies you've seen, there is a distinction between how well lit they are. I'm thinking of The Ritual being very dark. So if those points addressed, you know, the similarities and the differences, let's kind of get into a list of horror comedies and, you know, talk about them a bit. I did put out feelers for horror comedies to discuss in this podcast. So let us do just that. One of the first persons to respond was Slay the Stars on Twitter from Slay the Stars podcast. It said, Cabin in the Woods, it being funny while also a really effective horror movie. And it is one in quite a line of meta horror movies that, through its metatextual nature, was also a comedy. I'm thinking Scream being one of those, but let's talk about Cabin in the Woods first. It's basically the premise of a kind of hillbilly horror slasher film with the tropes of the horny teenagers going off into this abandoned cabin in the woods for a vacation to do drugs and have sex, and by doing so be killed off one by one for their moral failings, and with the survivor being a virgin. And it plays around with this mythology, creating these tropes of the athlete and the virgin and the, I guess, the femme fatale, the wanton lady, the stoner, the fool, I guess. And that to prevent the end of the world, sacrifices have to be made. And these tropes, these types, have to be sacrificed. My issue with Cabin in the Woods is that these archetypes are forced upon the characters, that they're not naturally that way, that they have to be drugged and socially engineered to behave in a certain fashion, that the jock is actually really intelligent, but they have to kind of dumb him down somehow. They pump aphrodisiacs into the cabin to make the teens hornier than they would be. Though I do like the office-like environment, the workplace comedy of running this weird end-of-the-world scenario, you know, trying to prevent it. Kind of reminds me of the teams you'd see in the Godzilla movies to fight these giant monsters that come by and attack Tokyo every once in a while. But when you start to remove agency from your characters, you're kind of playing with fire. Is that for narrative to work well, I think your characters have to have some say in the matter. And you get a little bit of that towards the end when, you know, there's spoilers galore in this podcast, but when the stoner character does the countercultural thing and just says, no, we're not going to sacrifice ourselves to this phenomenon. And our final girl is very much in the same thought process, is like, no, we're not going to continue this weird sacrifice thing. And so these old ones, these old gods, which I kind of wish were Cthulhu creatures rather than just giant men. I think it would have been cool if they were just like the old ones, you know, very Lovecraftian, but I guess beggars can't be choosers. Yeah, they just invite the end of the world rather than just play the same roles over and over again. There's little moments in Cabin in the Woods that I really like. It did give us the line, the husband bulge, which is weird and seems very Joss Whedon-y, which is, these days, not a good thing. Also, the Japanese schoolgirls getting together and chanting, and like they convert the monster in some kind of frog, I think it was. It's been a while since I've seen it, but that, you know, all across the world, the other institutions that were behind this, you know, prevention of the end of the world were failing, and America was the last chance, and they failed too. So Scream, meta commentary on the slasher and the horror film, and very referential, which is kind of the comedy of the hour these days, you know, just to make references to things you've seen before and having that be the source of comedy. But what Scream does really well is show the killer not being this superhuman entity like your Michael Myers or your Jasons, that the ghost face killer gets hurt, stubs the toe, gets slammed into a door, trips, gets stabbed, you know, has things smacked over his head. So there's this little touch of realism, of grounding the scenario. But the more you get into the franchise, you know, the sequels, the more convoluted and weird it becomes, and it gets trapped and kind of mired in its own lore and starts to suffer the weird kind of nonsense that surrounds stuff like later installments of Halloween, where you have like a Michael Myers cult, and later Friday the 13th when Jason can inhabit multiple bodies because he's some kind of weird demonic slug. You know, there's a time where things get too convoluted for their own good. Saw franchise is notorious for that too, being just knots of weird narrative and prequels and sequels and side characters having their own spin-off kind of weird Saw franchise stuff. It gets a little dense. Shadow of the Vampire is another good meta commentary on horror, though in a different way. The making of Nosferatu, but Max Schreck is an actual vampire. And so it's more of a meta commentary on filmmaking and the lengths a director will go to complete his vision. Tucker and Dale vs. Evil, another great meta horror film, taking the hillbilly horror thing and looking at it from the other side, where what is assumed to be the killers, these backwoods killers, are actually just two buddies who are looking to renovate a cabin and enjoy their time in the woods, or are pestered by a group of teenagers that, through their own fear response, are offing themselves in ridiculous ways, such as running headlong into a wood chipper or slamming into a fallen tree limb, getting impaled. Just a look at miscommunication and perception, such as one of the teenagers falling and hitting her head and being revived by our hillbilly buddies, and then helping around the cabin to, kind of pay back the generosity and going out and helping dig a trench, possibly for a latrine or an outhouse or what have you. And so the other teenagers spot this and think she's being forced to dig her own grave. It's just delightful comedy of errors with a lot of gore. The third act gets a little weird, though, when you do introduce a killer. I don't think the story naturally needed one, but it still works. Of course, you get your parodies as well with Young Frankenstein, which combines moments from the various Frankenstein films, but presents them in a humorous fashion, really. Released the same year as Blazing Saddles, which is mind-boggling. But Young Frankenstein, super funny. Looking at Gene Wilder being a descendant of Victor Frankenstein and distancing himself from the controversy of, raising the dead and so forth, the thing he thought impossible, only to be lured in when he inherits the castle and discovers his grandfather's work and starts creating his own creature. There are some problematic things regarding what looks like a scene of sexual assault, with the monster ravishing a woman and having her enjoy it, which is weird and probably very much of the time, but not something I think people might do today. But just full of great moments. The door to the secret laboratory, being in the library, put the candle back, Frau Brucher, a werewolf, their wolf, a delightful comedy, and with a lot of heart in how it treats the creature and imparting some of one's own intelligence, the doctor's own intelligence, into the monster, so that he's not so abnormal in the brain. I think it really shows Mel Brooks' love of the original series, something that's not the case with Spaceballs, which just seemed to be kind of cheap gags that were directed at a franchise that Mel Brooks had no love for. He wasn't a fan of Star Wars, and so didn't treat the content with as much respect or admiration as he did the Universal Monster movies. Okay, speaking of slapstick, Lee Metcalf of the Black Dog podcast brought up Evil Dead 2 as a horror comedy. And it's incredibly so, and it uses gore as slapstick, as gags. And I've seen this in other horror comedies like Dead and Breakfast, where somebody gets slaughtered during the middle of the night, and I think somebody goes downstairs and without really looking where they're going and starts slipping on all the gore and has trouble getting up. You know, get up and slip and fall again, get up, slip and fall again, and all this blood. And it's a really super funny scene. But there's something cartoonish and wild with Evil Dead 2. Sam Raimi and Bruce Campbell were fans of the Three Stooges, even referring to these villain roles as shemps or fake shemps. Like Bruce Campbell appears at the end of Darkman, and I believe he is Final Shemp. Just kind of these voiceless villain roles. But yeah, there's a lot of cartoonish chaos going on in Evil Dead 2. And a lot of times the gore is used in comedic fashion when Ash, played by Bruce Campbell, has to wrestle his own possessed hand that is punching him, grabbing him by the back of the lapel and flipping him in a judo-style fashion. And so Ash has to cut off his own hand, which then scurries about and flips him off and that sort of thing. There's a lot of gore and fake blood and slime and stuff just dumping over people, like extreme versions of So You Can't Say That on Television. Just geysers of fluid pouring out of walls or basements or what have you. Shaun of the Dead has a couple of scenes like that. The throwing records at a zombie, which why they thought that was a good plan at all, but there you go. Deciding what record to throw, what not. You know, this Prince album, no, I love that album. The Batman soundtrack, throw it. Also, when Shaun is going into the little corner shop and slips on a bit of blood, but doesn't really acknowledge it. There's bloody handprints everywhere, and he just leaves change for the thing he bought and keeps going. There are great moments of there of going back to Dawn of the Dead is the complacency that people were already zombies going about their daily routine, you know, riding the bus to work, and you'd see the impending zombie apocalypse happening around him, and Sean being so lost in his own problems that he was unable to see until it was too late the events taking place around him. I think with the Cornetto trilogy, considering all the violence involved, I think they're all horror films. I know they're supposed to be divided up between horror, action, and science fiction. You know, the red for blood, the blue for the thin blue line, and then the green for little green men. But the level of gore in each of the films is such that, yeah, they all feel very horror. Hot Fuzz really comes across more like a folk horror, like The Wicker Man or The Ritual or Midsommar or any of those, you know, folk horror films. Kind of has that vibe to it. And of course, you can have a science fiction film also be a horror film, like Invasion of the Body Snatchers. It can double. Alien 2, both science fiction and horror. But comedies as well. So one thing about Hot Fuzz is it points out the references it's making, which I think kind of undermines the jokes. If you have to point out the tropes that you're following, it's kind of like explaining the joke. It just, you don't need that in The World's End, and you don't need that in Shaun of the Dead. So why hang a lantern on all the jokes you're making in Hot Fuzz? Oh, this is a reference to Point Blank Break. Oh, this is a reference to Lethal Weapon. Not really necessary. So Andy Faraday brought up What We Do in the Shadows, which is a great mockumentary of vampire life, both the television series and the New Zealand film, though I think I prefer the television series. Though really, they're very similar in their style and presentation and content. Yeah, just to follow the lives of vampires and how they subsist as the years pass, how they adapt or fail to do so, you know, learning about technology, dressing for the occasion, and how they play with their food. It's like you're eating worms sort of thing. And just looking at different types of vampires, which they expanded on in the television series by adding an energy vampire to the mix rather than kind of the twilighty vampire that we get in the film. It's kind of a great fourth wall breaking narrative. The talking heads kind of one camera setup of a day in the life of these vampires, and just to follow them over time. And all the weird exploits they get into, such as their rivalry with the werewolves, where we get the great line, "We are werewolves, not swearwolves." Dance of the Dead, that was a fun zombie movie. Classics like The Raven, Vincent Price and Peter Lorre. I believe that's the name of the film, where Vincent Price owns a funeral home and he and his assistant, who's played by Peter Lorre, are offing off various neighbors and creditors to, you know, not only lighten their burden for having to pay back people, but make some cash as well in selling lots and coffins and so forth. Saturday the 14th is an odd one. Kind of a free-for-all, making fun of all kinds of horror films. I believe it has a creature from the Black Lagoon kind of thing in the bathtub, which I think even predates the Freddy Krueger claw coming up through the water. I remember characters around the breakfast table and the dad looks down into his mug of coffee and there's an eyeball staring back at him. He says, "I don't like the look of this coffee." You know, those kind of jokes. Student Bodies, which is a parody of your prom night type slasher. It has a pretty funny thing at the end during the prom where our final girl dresses up in this tight dress that kind of pushes your boobs together, and then you just hear this balloon squeaking sound, which is something the Black Dog Podcast has adopted anytime, you know, somebody's dressed in super tight clothing, this noise, you know, of running your finger across a balloon or two balloons against each other, that kind of squeak. Demon Knight's a fun one. I believe that's the name of the Tales from the Crypt Presents film with Billy Zane. Has some really great funny moments to it, especially I think coming from Billy Zane. House has some weird funny elements. It doesn't quite work tonally because we're working with a Vietnam vet who had a painful divorce after their son went missing, and yet somehow there's these weird comedic elements to the film. It doesn't really juggle the comedy and the horror well. They seem two separate things. I think it's House 2 that brings the Caterpuppy and the pirate kind of gold digger ghost far more entertaining. Creepshow had that fun, subversive, underground comic book vibe to it, being a collaboration between Stephen King and Romero. It's a very darkly comedic in spots. Pretty broad comedy for most of the chapters in this anthology. The broadest perhaps being the one that's starring Stephen King as this backwoods farmer who touches this meteor and starts to grow moss and weeds and stuff on his person until it's basically overwhelmed, becoming a plant himself, more or less. There's the Scary Movie franchise, which Scary Movie was the original title for Scream. But yeah, being reference-heavy parodies that probably are diminishing returns and very offensive, even at the time. The gym coach whose testicles hang below her skirt kind of thing, just not in good taste at all. Though I did laugh despite myself at Anna Faris getting beaten up, because it was socially unacceptable, and I think that's what I found so funny about it. It was cartoonish violence against a woman in a weird way, and it was so shocking that, and so just obviously faked, because, you know, Anna Faris was just pulling faces at the time she was getting beat up, that, you know, it was clearly cartoonishly absurd. Happy Death Day, I have not seen yet, but I've heard good things. Heard less good things about the sequel. Child's Play and the Chucky films, you definitely get this running narrative from this killer doll, which is a source of humor. That's what happens with a lot of these horror franchises. Your Freddy Krueger, clearly, you know, third movie and on, and a little bit in the second, I guess, though the second is a weird one, that you have Freddy start joking around, and it's because he becomes less the antagonist, less the heavy, and more the reason people are going to see it, even though he's a child murderer and probably worse, though they generally don't get too deep into what he did with the kids other than kill them. But I think we can all assume that he was not a good guy, though I do find that Robot Chicken segment funny about Noah's kid getting him this itchy shirt, and so he's just being irritable and people assuming the worst about him when he was actually an innocent guy. Ready or Not, I think that's another one of these rich family and somebody not involved with this rich family, except, you know, possibly marrying into it, has to play this game to be invited into the family, and there's like this deal with this demon that is the source of their wealth. And every once in a while, you know, sometimes it's just a simple game, like maybe Monopoly, maybe cards, you know, just a simple game she has to play. But every once in a while, it's a violent version of hide and seek. Tusk is one I've never seen, but the Kevin Smith movie about this mad scientist doctor that converts some wayward person into a walrus. This, you know, film that was pitched in a podcast and got backers and eventually became a thing. Never saw it, though. Jennifer's Body, that is getting a kind of a second life in podcasting, especially by women and queer reviewers, that it originally, when Jennifer's Body was being released at theaters, they marketed it wrong because they didn't market it to, you know, women and feminists. And because it really is more in that vein, that they tried to profit off the hotness of Megan Fox and tried to appeal to men. And men just didn't get what the film was doing, or being a movie about female friendship and the pitfalls therein. There's many, I think, particularly in Scandinavia, that look at Midsommar as a comedy. Zombieland, though I was not a fan of Zombieland, I can certainly see the comedy aspects of the film. Get Out certainly had its funny moments, being a look at neoliberalism and its relationship with blackness. Of course, there's also all the horror comedies that are directed more for children, your Goosebumps, your Witches, your Hocus Pocuses. I think that's a good list of movies to kind of address and, you know, kind of point out what they're doing with the format. It's a format that can or cannot work depending on your tastes, because comedy is subjective. Whether you find something funny or offensive is up to you. Or if it's just flat and not funny at all, just cringe or awkward. Or maybe it's seems to try too hard, or maybe it's a little too cerebral, a little too highbrow, or a little too lowbrow. That really depends on the viewer and their taste. Anyhow, that's horror comedies in a nutshell. We're going to probably take next week off, as we have a family meeting to attend, and I doubt we're going to have time to record anything then. Hopefully we'll be able to get to the tarot in a fortnight's time. It should be a spooky one. The judgment, even though the card itself and its meanings generally aren't spooky related, the imagery of the card definitely is, as it's very apocalyptic in a biblical sense. But we'll get into that when the time comes. And then, of course, there's the music special that relates to the tarot, and yeah, I'll have that mix available at the end of this month, hopefully. I'm experiencing some pretty bad allergies at the moment, so I'm going to see about taking myself to bed. Take care out there, and hopefully you'll hear from us soon. Bye!
You have been listening to the Dark Corner Podcast with David and Brandy Jacola. Please rate, review, and subscribe. Also, recommend us to your weird friends. You know the ones. Follow us on Twitter at Dark Corner Cast and at Brandy112. 12 is a number. Brandy also hosts several Star Trek podcasts, such as Boldly Go, What the Future Holds, and The Vedic Assembly. Watch her discuss Star Trek Live with Dan Gunther on the Unready Room at 7 p.m. Mountain Time, most Saturday evenings on the Kurt Ratz YouTube channel. Kurt Ratz is Star Trek spelled backwards. The opening track to The Dark Corner is Start the Ride by Diversant 13. The closing track is Goodbye by Violet Tears. The Dark track was offered for free or has been submitted by the artist or artist's representative. All other music is used for demonstrative purposes and no infringement of copyright is intended. For more music, please visit DJ Evil Dave's SoundCloud page. Thank you again for visiting our tiny dark corner of the internet.
Dark Corner.